Hello and welcome to another special bonus episode of Damn Interesting Week. This bonus episode is all about language and communication and the sometimes surprising forms that that can take. Of course, we here on the podcast love to talk, and you presumably like to listen, so we can only assume that this collection of articles will be right up your alley. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
And these were some damn interesting weeks.
First Link.
This next article comes from BBC Future. It's got a little bit of an alarmist headline, but it's called The Movements That Betray Who You Are.
Ooh.
So this article focuses on nonverbal code switching, basically. There was some research that was done in the late 1980s where they noticed something strange about photographs in a famous study. What they had done is ask volunteers if they were able to identify emotions in the faces of Japanese and Caucasian people. But some of the Japanese faces were posed by Japanese Americans and the rest were by Japanese nationals. And what they were able to find out is they could tell who was a Japanese American or a Japanese national. Even though the faces were Japanese, there was something in the expression that gave away something else to their identity. So they ran another experiment. And what they found was that Americans were strangely good at spotting who was Japanese and who was Japanese American, even though they were all ethnically the same. They wore the same clothes, they were lit in the same way. When the two groups held neutral expressions, people could barely differentiate between them. But when they showed their feelings, especially sadness, something from Japan or America seemed to emerge. And this might be something you've experienced if you've ever been abroad and you could just kind of tell that maybe someone passing by was an expat. For example, when you count to three, people can do it in different ways, right? We kind of pin our little finger with our thumb and we raise our pointer finger, middle finger, ring finger. That's how we count to three in America. Mm-hmm. But in Germany, they raise their thumb for first and then the first two fingers.
Mm-hmm.
So you never really think about this until you see someone doing it differently, which then all of a sudden looks super strange. And sometimes these are very intentional. For example, Vladimir Putin is said to display his KGB weapons training in the way he walks, with his gun arm hanging motionless by his side. And that's sort of his way of flexing, like, hey, I've had KGB training. I might have a gun here. Super macho.
Oh, so they feel like he's doing that on purpose. It's not
exactly.
I've internalized this. It's more like, no, let me show you.
I mean, that's speculation. And I think that there may be something to that speculation there. But since this initial discovery, the researchers have detected more of these, what they're calling nonverbal accents. So these physical ways in which we can show where we come from without realizing it. For example, Americans can often spot Australians from the way they smile, wave, or walk. They've even found that facial expressions during orgasm can carry different cultural accents. Unfortunately, they didn't go into detail on that one. I'm sure you can do your own research if you are so inclined. But we've got more recent research that's now supporting these findings. A team at the University of Glasgow has trained a computer to recognize and then generate more than 60 different nonverbal accents on a simulated face. And these are really subtle, almost indecipherable differences, like the way a nose wrinkles or the way that a lip is raised. But when East Asians were shown these artificial East Asian expressions, they recognize them way more easily than the Western ones. They're thinking that eventually a robot should be able to simulate the tiny nuances for any culture and any occasion across the world. But this whole nonverbal accents thing really isn't surprising, nor is it terribly new. I mean, you can often recognize individual voices and faces or even walking and running styles without knowing exactly what about it makes it recognizable, right? Mm-hmm. There's a Chinese technology company called Waytrix that claims their software can identify a person from footage of them walking with accuracy up to 94%. So if an individual's movements can be so distinctive, then it's not unreasonable to think that groups might share a few things in common, and this might be noticeable to people that are outsiders, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I've experienced that. Someone that I know very well, if I happen to see them at a great distance, I can say, oh yeah, I know that so-and-so because of their walk. But I wouldn't necessarily be able to say, I could be like, that's an American at that grocery store.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. There was a classic study in, I think, at Princeton University, where psychologists found participants were good at picking election winners just by choosing who looked more capable from a pair of photographs. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this took place some time ago, and we live in a very different world now. But in this study, even children became decent political pundits when they were shown the same pictures and they were asked to choose an imaginary captain for a video game. Obviously, there appears to be no connection between looking reliable and actually being reliable. But
right, but that's we don't base our choices on actual fact. We base it on what things feel like. That's for
exactly.
Sure.
And as we get into a hyper media saturated world and information economy, where being mediagenic is that much more important, it's likely to kind of extrapolate that you could kind of not weaponize, but maybe take advantage of some of these things to portray the thing that you want to have people have an impression of you, right?
Oh, man. Imagine, like, okay, go with me here. In like a futuristic society where in an effort to block that, we basically force all politicians to have the same super generic generated face. So it's like, you know, three versions of like, you know, whatever, handsome JFK or something. And all three of them look exactly identical, but they're saying their actual policy positions and you would have to vote based entirely on what they said. Like
I admire your optimism. Your unfailing optimism about the future and the human condition gives me hope.
I don't know that it is optimism. It feels kind of dystopian to me because it's also
very
like
dystopian.
You could put whoever you want in office at the end because no one would know. No one would have any idea who was actually up there.
Yeah, kind of like how they chose Reagan, who was a seasoned, you know, media professional to basically act as a front piece, mouthpiece for a really vast, okay, I'm getting a little tinfoil hat. Here, but you know, some of the research might be new, but a lot of these mechanisms and the way
right.
that we understand this as humans, definitely not new. But I'll end on a high note here. There was one recent study from the University of Wisconsin-Madison that suggests that the nonverbal cues that we give here might have given an upbeat accent to modern Americans. So the theory here is that residents of a place that have high immigration will often struggle to understand each other. Everybody's kind of other. They've got all these different cues and nonverbal accents, but in order to cope in ordinary life, they have to try a little harder. So as a result, the authors are speculating that a lot of smiling and pantomiming of emotions would have been required or are still required in a lot of ways. And so when they checked the available data, they did find that people in countries with high ancestral diversity, including the US, reported smiling more often. And this is a criticism that you can hear a lot from Europeans in particular, right? It's why Americans might think that Europeans are cold or snooty, and Americans to Europeans seem ridiculously cheerful to everyone, right, including strangers. And it might be because we've got these histories of wanting to foster this connection in order to make everyday life a little bit smoother. But just don't demand only women do the smiling.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, in Texas, you never know who's got a gun.
That's right. You have to smile because you don't know.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yep. Next link.
Next link. This article comes to us from BBC.com. It's titled The Secret Letters of History's First Known Businesswomen. So around 1870 BC, in the city of Assur in northern Iraq, a woman called Ahaha uncovered a case of financial fraud. She had invested in long-distance trade between Assur and the city of Kanesh in Turkey. But Ahaha's shares of the profit seemed to have gone missing, possibly embezzled by one of her own brothers, Buzazi. So she grabbed a reed stylus and a clay tablet and scribbled a letter to another brother, Assur Metapil, pleading for help. And she wrote, "I have nothing else apart from these funds. Take care to act so that I will not be ruined. Let a detailed letter come from you to me by the very next caravan. Now is the time to do me a favor and save me from financial stress."
See, I wonder what's been lost in translation, because, like, what's the Assyrian equivalent of, like, as per my last tablet? Like, you know, like, I don't imagine she was as polite as it maybe comes out to sound in our modern language, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So the businesswoman's story is tied to that of the Assyrian merchant community as a whole. In their heyday, the Assyrians were among the most successful and well-connected traders of the Near East. Their caravans of up to 300 donkeys would crisscross mountains and uninhabited plains, carrying raw materials, luxury goods, and clay letters. So the commercial acumen allowed some of these women to slip into positions that were unusual for them at the time by functioning as their husband's trusted business partners. Mm. The traders, in turn, benefited from having literate and numerate wives who could help with day-to-day business as well as emergencies. One Assyrian merchant writes to his wife, "Urgent, clear your outstanding merchandise, collect the gold of the son of Limishar, and send it to me. Please put all my tablets in safekeeping."
Uh-oh.
Yeah, sounds like
somebody's
trouble.
Somebody's going to get audited? Like, I want to know what that is.
Yeah. Others ask their wives to pick specific tablets from the household's private archives to find financial information or settle a business matter. Mm-hmm. And the women, in turn, don't shy away from sending their husbands or brothers instructions and admonishments. An Assyrian woman called Naramtum writes to two men, "What is this that you do not even send me a tablet two fingers wide with good news from you?"
How dare you?
Yeah. She complains about a dispute involving debt and lost merchandise and urges the men to resolve it, closing with a brisk, "Send me the price of the textiles. Cheer me up." Another chided her brother over a missing payment, saying, "Don't be so greedy that you ruin me." So, like, you know, this is like business talk.
Yeah,
I love it.
That's fantastic.
And these women's independence stood in stark contrast to some other societies in the ancient Near East, such as Near Babylonia in southern Iraq. Mitchell points out that in Assur, as in Kanesh, both the wife and the husband could ask for a divorce and would be treated the same in the proceedings. But at exactly the same time in Babylonia, if she dared to ask, she would just be put to death.
Right.
Which is a little excessive, if you ask me.
But consistent with history, if we're being honest here.
Yeah.
I like that we've registered your opinion on it. Like, you know, just for the record, I'm against putting women to death if they want to.
I just want to make sure people know where I stand
right,
on the
right.
issue. Okay.
It's good. Yeah. It's important. Yeah.
So with that strengthened economic influence came better conditions in the women's personal lives. A number of them added clauses to marriage contracts that banned the men from taking second wives or traveling by themselves, as in this example, Assur Malik married Sukana, daughter of Rim Assur. Wherever Assur Malik goes, he shall take her with him. He shall not marry another woman in Kanesh. Which, I don't know, it seems like there's some loophole in that clause to me, but
just go right outside the city limits and then
yeah, exactly. At some point, for reasons that are somewhat unclear, trade between Assur and Kanesh declined, and eventually Kanesh was deserted. But the women's clay tablets, hardened by house fires, remained in the abandoned homes to be discovered thousands of years later. And they captured a female experience so rarely documented in history, not of queens or high priestesses, but of working women just figuring out how to get through the next day. And all of this comes from only roughly half of those some 20,000 tablets from Kanesh. So there's likely tons more secrets waiting to spill out from this, you know, archaeological resource.
Well, I'm all about more drama. I want to hear more women being super mean to contractors yeah. and getting their money.
Yeah, hell yeah.
The original Karens?
Yeah, there you go.
Next link?
Next link.
All right, well, the British Psychological Society's Research Digest has an article called "It Turns Out You Can Kid a Kidder After All." I should note, I've taken a little editorial liberty on this one. The actual title of the article is "You Can't BS a BSer," and the full version of that word appears about 50 times in the article. So, you know, we try to keep it family friendly, so I've made some adjustments. But if for some reason you live in a world where you're still working out of an office and you know they monitor your internet browsing, you might want to wait till you get home to open this one up. That being said, it really is a fascinating article that touches on one of my favorite subjects, lying. Because, you know, being a performer and a writer is basically just being a professional liar. And I don't know about you guys, but I've always found that I'm very good at it, even when I'm not getting paid to do it.
Oh, no.
I refuse to answer that question on the
right,
air.
Right. So some earlier studies have suggested that better liars are also better at detecting lies. But a new study out of the University of Waterloo in Canada has looked a little more closely into the specifics of that, and they found some surprising results. The interesting thing they did that other studies haven't before was they separated lying into two categories. There's persuasive lying, which is usually motivated by a desire to impress people, right? These are your big fish stories, your tall tales about that wild thing that happened to you one time. Then there's evasive lying, which is meant to cover up a mistake or put a positive spin on something like a politician would.
Mm-hmm.
So participants in the study were first asked to complete a lying frequency scale, again, not called a lying frequency scale, rating how likely they were to lie in different situations, including when the truth would hurt someone, but also things like when you want to contribute to a business meeting but don't actually understand the topic. Then they were presented with a long list of statements and asked to rate how profound each one was. One example of a genuinely profound statement was, "A river cuts through a rock, not because of its power, but its persistence," which is, you know, a cute little thing you might see on a poster. While the pseudo-profound sentences were more like a nonsensical mash of buzzwords, like, "We are in the midst of a high-frequency blossoming of interconnectedness that will give us access to the quantum soup itself," which I can't imagine who's fooled by a sentence about the quantum soup. But I guess somebody is.
I mean, I read my horoscope. I would read the rest of that article.
Right? I read the business news. I'd read the rest of the article.
Well, what they found was that frequent evasive liars were significantly better than average at picking out the pseudo-profound sentences, while frequent persuasive liars were significantly worse at it. The frequent persuasive liars also did worse on basic cognitive tests like math and vocabulary and reported less insight into their own thoughts and feelings. Mm-hmm. They scored high in something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, meaning the dumber they were, the smarter they thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
High evasive liars, on the other hand, were again at the opposite end of the scale, scoring higher than average on the intellectual as well as the self-awareness tests. So basically, all liars think they're super smart, but only half of them actually are. And if you're wondering which category you fall into, the best way to figure it out is to look at what type of lies you usually tell.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's basically like the little fingers of society are smart.
Right,
and the braggadocious Game of Thrones character who got his head crushed by that huge guy, not so smart. I mean, that tracks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, and it fits with what you feel like you know about the people around you, right? You're next to somebody who's always like, "Oh my God, they're crazy." And you're like, "Yeah, you're dumb." But there's definitely manipulative people out there. We're like, "Oh, you're very clever. Like you, you're dangerous." And the authors did note it's important that they never tested how good any of these liars actually were at lying, just how often they said they did it. I took an entire class in college called Lying and Deception, and it was fantastic. There's so much cool work on liars out there. Like, we covered a ton of studies showing things like people with natural leadership skills also had the best lying skills, because you have to be able to frame something in the way that everybody wants to hear it for their own purposes. And at one point, we actually had a guest lecture from a police officer who administers lie detector tests. And he basically told us, like, how people can beat them and all sorts of fun stuff. It's really, really fascinating.
What a great class, but a dangerous one to teach in college.
Yeah, it was very weird. I don't know why it was available for credit or otherwise, but it was one of my favorite classes. I feel like when you study that sort of thing, you maybe get better at lying yourself, but you also do get better at knowing when you're being lied to.
Right.
And I think that's a counteractive thing that can be very helpful, especially today. That was one of the things they tested them on, was like, how easily swayed were they by various fake news things? And of course, the braggadocious people were just like, "Yes, this is all true." And the evasive liars were like, "Nope, not buying any of it." So as Wei said, I'm going to decline to answer on how often or in what situations I lie. But I, as the study shows, I do think I'm very good at it. So that tracks. That makes sense. Next link.
Next link. This article comes to us from HakaiMagazine.com, and it's titled, "The Military Wants to Hide Covert Messages in Marine Mammal Sounds."
Yes, please. So,
not where I thought that was going. All right.
Yeah, I know, right? That's why I paused dramatically. So Chinese researchers have recently published a series of studies describing how to disguise underwater communications as artificial dolphin clicks and killer whale songs, potentially allowing stealthy submarines or underwater drones to cryptically pass covert military communications between each other or a home base. So they're not literally getting dolphins or whales to speak
code. Them, right.
Yeah, because that's what I thought when I first encountered this article. But still, you know, cool as well, I guess. So mimicking marine mammal sounds to disguise military communication is a decades-old idea that has resurfaced. The U.S. military's Project Combo tested using recordings of whale and dolphin songs as the basis for secret code that might go unnoticed by enemy eavesdroppers. And, you know, you'll recall that during the Cold War era, that's where they had all these weird ideas about everything. but the Chinese researchers' efforts seem to have gone a step beyond by using modern technology to create artificial whale and dolphin sounds from scratch rather than relying on pre-existing recordings. Caitlin Frazier, who is an oceanographer and data scientist at the University of California, San Diego, says there have clearly been many recent advances in artificial signal synthesis, but the technology is likely to run up against the same limitations that prior projects have encountered, including limits on how far away such sounds can be detected, unwanted distortion of the signal caused by changing temperatures or other environmental factors that affect the bending and bouncing of sound waves, and interference from other ocean noises.
Well, and you never know what you might actually be saying to the dolphins and whales. Like, you could start a revolution yeah. underwater without even knowing it.
Your exactly. mother smelt of elderberries.
yeah. So, despite all these challenges, sound is the ideal form of long-distance communication in the ocean's depths, which limit efficient transmission of light and radio waves. In 1973, the Navy successfully carried out tests between stationary underwater speakers and receivers at distances of up to 32 kilometers and depths of 75 meters, which is, you know, pretty deep and pretty far. The following year, the submarine USS Dolphin used the technique to swap messages with the surface ship, so this has actually been happening in practice. But the sensing and computing technology of the time faced limits in detecting the whale sounds without distortion, not to mention creating artificial whale sounds from scratch or decoding more complex meanings within artificially generated signals, which were totally, you know, out of the question at the time. This meant that Project Combo's experiments relied on pre-recorded pilot whale sounds to build a predetermined codebook with simple messages, rather than trying to synthesize customized messages on the fly. And for their recordings, the Naval settled on pilot whale sounds because of their efficient underwater transmission ranges, but also because the whale's global presence meant that they could potentially send messages around the world without arousing suspicion. Because, you know, if you send like a, I don't know where whales live, the different types of whales, but
right.
the wrong whale showing up in the wrong ocean is kind of a dead giveaway there. So modern advances in sensors and computing have allowed Chinese researchers at Harbin Engineering University and Tianjin University to potentially overcome some of these prior limitations. Roy Diamant, an electrical and computer engineer at the University of Haifa in Israel, who previously designed a covert underwater communication system for a defense technology company, says, "The idea is that you take the signal that the animal is making and you're using it as your baseline signal. From there, transforming whale and dolphin sounds into a code that carries complex meaning for humans isn't easy. Many whales produce sounds at lower frequencies where the bandwidth available for constructing meaningful messages is limited, but sperm whales actually communicate using clicks that can have a wider bandwidth, but their short duration means that the transmission energy and therefore the possible distance of communication is limited. So there's a bunch of factors in, you know, developing a convincing fake underwater mammal sound.
Right, that'll be of any use to you, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. So the dolphin family that includes killer whales and pilot whales transmit at higher frequencies, which may be more suitable for encoding messages, but Diamond and other experts suggest that any such effort is likely to result in inefficient communications only suited for sending simple text-style messages. Which I kind of had a chuckle at, thinking of people just being like, "What you doing?" like, WYD.
The dolphin equivalent of "you up?"
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you're not going to be transmitting books to one another. You could say "go" or "I'm here" or fairly simple stuff like that. But if you're trying to coordinate the movements of vessels or anything like that, it'd be much less clear. So there's also one potential problem here. No one knows how this kind of covert communication system, whether it's echolocation or vocalizations, could affect actual marine mammals. Would they be confused? Previous experiments suggest whales and dolphins can quickly figure out when the sound being played is a recording or otherwise artificial, but they might still change their behavior in response by increasing and changing their own vocalizations. And dolphins are actually known to whistle back in response to signals in their whistle frequency band, and we have known them to actually jam those frequencies with intense whistling in response to a stimulus. And yeah, so dolphins, including pilot whales, are generally quite curious, so it's likely that they'd be intrigued by and respond to these signals.
Or we have said something so offensive to them that
That's
they're
right.
just all like, it's a cacophony of outrage. Like, how dare you?
Yeah.
So that could mean negative impacts for whales or dolphins if their sudden flurry of communication in response to artificial noise gives away their own location to predators and prey. Artificial signals could also cause them to abandon their current plans and move away from the noise. Mm. And at the very least, the system could just distract the animals and waste their time by forcing them to figuring out what's going on, mm-hmm. which is very considerate of this article and the researchers involved.
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole premise of this is basically hijacking their own communication for our mm-hmm. needs. So, like, the basic common courtesy of, like, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not that impressed.
I don't know if
you all
heard those AI-generated human voices yet, but they're very creepy, especially if they're like saying nonsense. So I can totally see it.
Yeah. The uncanny valley of dolphin speaking. It's like,
yeah. So in the US, if we're to use such a technique, there'd have to be experimental proof that the challenge posed was not overwhelming for any other species in the area where you're planning on using it. Laws such as the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972 have given rise to regulatory efforts aimed at controlling the amount of noise humans generate in the oceans, and military organizations such as NATO have standards for underwater sounds. But a military could still conduct such experiments secretly without notifying anyone, and as Diamond points out, just because you can't read about it anymore doesn't mean they don't do it.
Right.
Yeah. So, if dolphins suddenly start acting real weird, could be
our
Chinese,
fault.
Could be us, could be anybody, really. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm cynical because, you know, on the one hand, they're like, oh, we don't want to disrupt the dolphins. But also, if you disrupt the dolphins and the whales and they leave or they change their behavior, that just means your code is no longer good. Mm-hmm. So, it still feels very self-serving. I don't know if they care that
totally.
Much.
Yeah. Or this could open up a new, like, genre of music where we have, like, collaborations dropping with our marine mammal friends. And,
that's right.
You know, I mean, like dolphin rap, I would listen to that feature.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's Flipper featuring Pitbull, right? Like,
perfect.
Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. CNN Style has reported that a rare locked letter that was sealed 300 years ago has finally been opened virtually.
Ooh. Oh.
So 300 years ago, before we had envelopes, before we had passwords, there were a lot of attempts to make letters private. And one popular way was to use a technique called letter locking, which was an origami-like, intricately folded flat sheet of paper that essentially became its own envelope.
Hmm.
577 locked letters were delivered to The Hague in the Netherlands between 1689 and 1706 and were found in a trunk of undelivered mail. So these letters had never reached their final recipients, and conservators did not want to open and damage them. So instead, a team has found a way to read one of the letters without breaking the seal in any way. What they did was use a highly sensitive X-ray scanner and computer algorithms to virtually unfold the unopened letter.
Huh.
The letter itself is just kind of meh. It was a request from a French guy to his cousin, but the researchers say that the letter gives fascinating insight into the lives of ordinary people, so kind of a snapshot of the early modern world as it went about its business.
Hmm.
The trunk of correspondence belonged to a postmaster called Simon de Brienne and his wife, postmistress Marie Germain. It was acquired by the Museum Voor Communicatie in The Hague in 1926. So in addition to the unopened letters, it contains 2,571 opened letters and fragments that for one reason or another never reached their destination. I think that for one reason or another is a really kind way of saying someone stole the letters.
Yeah. If a bunch of unopened letters are in the possession of a postmaster, it sounds like he's bad at his job. Like he's not supposed to be holding these things.
But these X-ray scanners were originally designed to map the mineral content of teeth, of all things, and they were mostly used in dental research until now. So the scanning technology, it's similar to medical CT scanners, but uses much more intense X-rays. And one tantalizing application could be to virtually unfold sealed items and letters in the prize papers, which is an archive of documents confiscated by the British from enemy ships between the 17th and 19th centuries.
So they have all these other letters sitting around that they think they could now apply this to that might have more information than just, hey, how are you? The weather's fine.
Right. Maybe war correspondence because it was taken from enemy ships, exploration intent.
And if you go to your dentist and you have a letter hidden inside your mouth, they can read it while you're also getting your teeth X-rays. Like two birds with one stone. What I'm saying.
Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I have a quick one here. It's sort of an article in video form. It's a little explainer from Vox called Why the U.S. Has Two Different Highway Fonts. And I don't know if you guys have ever noticed this phenomenon, but as a moderately obsessive person, I definitely have, and it's annoyed me.
Yeah. Now that you mention it.
Yeah. It looks unprofessional.
Is it, like, even within the same state or same city?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, if you drive out on I-35 right now, if you pay attention, you will see signs in different fonts from the highway sign you just passed.
Oh, no.
It's bizarre.
I'm never going to unsee this once I see it.
And, you know, you assume it's just like a conflict between state and national standards, or maybe there isn't a standard.
Right.
But thanks to this video, now I do know. So the original font for road signs is called Highway Gothic, and it was designed in 1948 by the California Department of Transportation with the specific goal, not surprisingly, of being very readable at high speeds. And there are some unusual things about it. The kerning, or the, like the space between the letters in a word, is irregular. Like an E and an R are actually closer together than an R and a G. Hmm. And Highway Gothic was the standard for decades. But then, in the 1980s, reflective sign technology became the norm. And this was a great improvement for things like stop signs, where you need to make sure you grab the driver's attention. But when it came to text, they started to notice that people were having problems with halation, where light is scattered unevenly and light-colored items on a dark background appear to get a sort of halo around them. And Highway Gothic had been given a very bolded, thick shape to make it stand out during the day. Hmm. But with halation, things like a lowercase a and an e and an o were all blurring into the same unrecognizable blob. Mm-hmm. So they threw science at the problem, and a group of researchers at Penn State University ran a bunch of tests on a real driving course to figure out what was the ideal font for readability both at night and during the day. And they called their result Clearview. Hmm. It's much thinner, the kerning is spread out even farther, and a lot of letters, like the lowercase l, now get a little tail to the right or some other extra detail to further distinguish them from other letters. And actually, in testing, it only showed a 16% improvement over Highway Gothic, which doesn't seem like a lot, but they said at speeds of 60 miles per hour, that translates into an extra 1 to 2 seconds to read and think about what you're seeing, which, when you're coming up on a sudden exit, can make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Still, it wasn't until 2004 that the Federal Highway Administration got around to approving Clearview as an option for new signs, and only around 30 states adopted it. So if you're listening to this podcast from, say, Minnesota or Georgia, you're not going to have any idea what we're talking about. And you never may, because now that they've thrown all these mismatched signs up, more recent studies have called into question the improved readability of Clearview, especially when it comes to their numbering system as opposed to their alphabet.
Oh, boy.
So today, the FHWA's official position is that either font is acceptable, but they make no recommendation on which is superior. And just to get a quote from an extreme font nerd in here, professional typeface designer Tobias Frere Jones says that on a purely mechanical level, he believes Clearview is more successful, but, quote, there's something very distinctly American about Highway Gothic. It's a bit blunt and stumbling and loud, and Clearview is almost in that respect too polished. So,
wow, what I feel triggered.
Right? You're like, no, Clearview here on out. I'm a Clearview girl. All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this bonus episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. As always, if you'd like to support our podcast and free us from the tyranny of our day jobs, you can do so at patreon.com/daminterestingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.